This is the Preparedness Radio Network, preparing you for natural and man-made disasters. Helpful tips on gardening and homesteading. Be prepared. And remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Yeah?
Did you want to see me, sir?
Well, I did, but now that I do, I'm not so sure.
Sir?
Johnson, I got a mission for you that could change your life.
Oh, good, sir.
It involves traveling halfway around the world without so much as half a clue of where you're going and what you're going to do when you get there.
Situation normal, sir?
Uh-huh. Well, I'll be leading this mission, Johnson, so I'll be telling you what to do.
You, sir?
That's right, Johnson, and I say first things first.
Oh, good plan, sir.
And what I say is first is food. Always remember that, Johnson. Food is a big deal.
Sir, my brother-in-law can get us a really good deal on some surplus MREs.
Johnson, if you've got half a brain and that empty head of yours, you'll call the freeze-dry guy like I did. That food is better for you, it rehydrates faster, and it's good, Johnson. And it keeps for up to 30 years.
Will we be gone that long, sir?
I hope not.
Now, get your supplies organized and meet me down to the pier at dawn on Sunday. We sail at sunrise.
Yes, sir.
This adventure is brought to you by the freeze-dry guy. Call 866-404-3663 or visit freezedryguy.com.
It's the 21st century, a dangerous world. Preppers need food and medicine. Why not have the best? Enterfood.com does the shopping, prep, and packaging for you using the best organic ingredients on the planet. Right now, specials are available for listeners of this station. The all-organic vegetarian food storage pail and the herbal medicine cabinet. The pail holds up to 120 flavorful meals, super packed fresh to last up to 15 years, soaked, cooked, or raw. The herbal medicine cabinet holds everything you'll need to cure common ailments. Use these items in an emergency or use them when camping. You can't beat these prices. Call to order now. 866-762-9238. 866-762-9238. Or go to enterfood.com. That's E-N-E-R-F-O-O-D.com. Enterfood.com.
Looking for power grid independence? The Humless Solar Kit is the answer. Increasing brownouts in the U.S. suggest it's time to get a backup. The problem is gas generators are messy, require maintenance, and oh, gas, which may be scarce in a real emergency. Get the Humless Solar Kit by itself or with a 1,000-watt Humless Sentinel generator. The kit includes a 100-watt solar panel, 20-foot extension cord, LED floodlight, rechargeable flashlights, and more. Become a fan at Humless.com or on Facebook.
BHM Radio is on the air on the Preparedness Radio Network. BHM Radio is the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine, expanding the stories you love in print live across the net. And now, your hosts for BHM Radio, Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci.
Hello, and welcome to BHM Radio, your source for the Backwoods Home Magazine, our sponsor. I really appreciate everybody showing up. My name is Colorado Ron, and Bubba Da Vinci is actually out of town this week, so I am doing this solo, which is awesome because that means I can say all the bad stuff I want about old Bubba, and he can't do anything about it. So that's great. Well, I appreciate everybody showing up for the show today. We have... our guest this this week is Jason Ackers. Jason Ackers is the he's the one that they call the self-sufficient gardener. Not only does he garden, but he hunts. He forages for wild foods. He does all kinds of stuff, and we're pretty excited to have him on. We'll have him on in a little bit later. But what I wanted to talk about, I wanted to start off. I know we only have an hour, so I really wanted to just jump right in, if that's okay with you guys, because one of the topics that I'll be talking about today is basically. It said in the description, end of the world scenarios. But what we're really going to be talking about is, first of all, there's all kinds of different end of the world scenarios out there. I mean, everything from a meteor or a comet to, wars, rumors of wars, you name it. But really, the most realistic thing that will probably happen is an economic collapse. Type scenario. Now, I was reading in my latest issue of Backwoods Home magazine, and I just lost it because I was reading another article. Not to jump off topic, but Build Your Own Car Wash. That is an awesome article. It is in the January-February issue on page 28. If you guys have Backwoods Home magazine, that is a cool car wash. I'm totally going to build that. Anyway, all right, back to what I was talking about. This article is on page 37, and it was written by Claire Wolf, and it's Apocalypse Wind is the name of the article. Again, it's on page 37 of Backwoods Home magazine. This article is really interesting. It's about it's a short read. It's about six pages, and what was really cool about this is I have a little bit of background in countries with economic issues because I'm actually good friends with Fernando Aguirre, who lives in Argentina. He's got a blog called Surviving Argentina. And I also have a friend named Thrander and Thorsen, and he lives in Iceland, both of which I knew before and after their economic collapses. Iceland had one, and so did so did Argentina. So that was really cool to be able to talk with them and actually go all the way through from start to finish what actually happened there. And being able to talk with them now gives me a whole different perspective because they're able to look at like what's happening in Greece and all these other countries over in Europe, and it's almost like Fernando said, he says Greece and what's happening in Greece is almost a carbon copy of what happened in Argentina. And the only reason that we're not in it as much trouble, and this was in the article again by Claire Wolf, one of the reasons that we're not in as much trouble as Greece is because Greece, uses the euro. And because all the other countries over there use the euro, they can't just print off more euros, where the U.S., we can just keep printing money. So we're able to last just a little bit longer, but not much. So anyway, I wanted to jump off into this topic just a little bit briefly before we have Jason on. And again, the article is on page 37. If you have your copy, you can open it up, and we'll talk about a little bit in there. As far as what's going on in Greece and being a carbon copy for what happened in Argentina, basically what happens is, the banks start to collapse. The country's government debts are 120% of GDP when the crisis began. And now they're at 170%. That's a lot. They're basically borderline failing. And the only, like I said, the only reason that they're getting saving grace, and really it's just a Band-Aid, is the bailout. Everybody knows that Germany is probably the strongest of the countries over in Europe, of the European countries, and so the problem is that Germany is the one that has to keep doing the bailouts. I actually called Fernando, who was overseas right now in Europe, and he said that the newspaper articles basically said that he grabbed the front page of the newspaper article, and it said that you're paying, I can't remember the exact amount, 500 or 5,000 pounds or euros, I'm sorry, 5,000 euros for the privilege of supporting Greece. And so, you know, it's articles like that are going to tick everybody off over there. So what I wanted to talk about, you know, everybody can read the article, but the results of what happens during an economic collapse is kind of what I wanted to concentrate on. The things that happened, and I talked with Thrander in Iceland. I was actually in Iceland in 2008, right before the collapse. I left, and no, it was not my fault, but I did leave like a couple days before the banks failed, and it was pretty crazy because at the time everything was hunky dory and normal when I was there, but then when I came back, you know, all their home loans were having issues, the banks were collapsing, jobs were being lost. Iceland tripled their unemployment to a whopping 4%. So, you know, they had very strong employment, not a lot of unemployed out there. So Argentina, on the other hand, their banks collapsed as well. And what happened with that is, you know, first of all, there's a run on the banks. Everybody is running to try and get out as much cash as they can. And so what they do is they shut down the banks, and then they, according to Fernando, what they did is they put a limit to how much you could pull out of your account. So even if you were a millionaire, you could only pull out $300 a week. And you had to pull it out in cash, and you had to pull it out at an ATM machine. The banks were actually closed, so you had to go to an ATM machine. So what the problem there was, every ATM machine became a hotspot for criminals. So, you know, Fernando told me several times that he'd walked around to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ATMs before he was able to find enough money in those machines to get his $300 limit out. So, you know, everybody's in line. The crooks are there. The crime, you know, crime rates around the ATM machines is, you know, off the chain. So it's nuts. And so those are some of the scenarios that you have to worry about. The sorry, I was just reading the it's throwing me off here. The Fernando lives in Ireland now, from Argentina. Now it's funny because I actually have friends who are here in the U.S. that are wanting to go to Argentina, and he just laughs and says they're crazy. He goes, everybody in Argentina is trying to get out of Argentina, and everybody in the United States, you know, grass is always greener on the other side. So I actually called Fernando today because I had a very interesting question for him that a lot of us would probably have, and that was that, you know, unemployment goes through the roof, and so chances are here in the U.S. During economic collapse, unemployment will go through the roof. So if that happens, a lot of us will not be able to pay our bills. I am in a lucky position where I have zero debt except for my home. So I called Fernando and I said, look, what happens if I'm in a situation where I cannot pay, if I cannot pay for my my house? And he said that you can then lose the home. And I said, well, what if everybody can't pay for it? And he says, well, they'll still foreclose. He goes, a whole neighborhood is being foreclosed on. So, you know, everybody's worried about this end of the apocalypse, you know, end of the world type deal, where, you know, sorry, I'm getting all kinds of messages here. Sorry, Jason Akers. Not Jason Akers. So is our guest, and he'll be on here shortly. So it was a concern of mine because my home, he said normally investors will still come in and purchase homes, even though they are, they're dropping off and people are losing their homes. Investors will come in at about 50% of the value of the house. Not the inflated value, but the true value. So let's just use round numbers here. Say my house is worth $400,000. If I owe $300,000 on my home, then chances are I'm in a bad spot. If I owe less than $200,000 on my home, I'm in a good spot because, like I said, home starts disappearing. If the value drops 50%, then the homes will start getting picked up by private investors. And, we've actually seen that here in Colorado. I'm not sure where everybody else is from, but here in Colorado, homes were dropping. See, my brother's home, he purchased for $200,000, and it dropped to about $130,000. And actually, when they go to foreclosure, I've seen them as low as $100,000. So that's about right, about 50%. And then investors are coming in and buying them, which is a good position to be in. Now, remember though that this economic collapse, if you watch what happened in Iceland, if you've watched what happened in Argentina, this is not an end all type situation where you're living off of just what's in your backyard and nobody's bugging you and you're surviving off the land. That's not how it's going to happen. Okay, so you're still going to have bills to pay. You're still going to have people are still looking for jobs, even though they're more scarce. And so everybody's kind of scrambling. Same thing happened in Iceland. Same thing happened in Argentina. People had no money. The value of their dollar dropped to nothing. It was, $100, but $100 was now worth a dollar, and they, you can't do much with that. And so, one of the things that Fernando said that a couple of people did, and this is kind of smart, is obviously hyperinflation kicks in, and so, here in the U.S., let's say, an ounce of gold is, $1,700 right now. And so that ounce of gold may be worth $100,000. It may bump up. And so, it will bump up during hyperinflation. So when that happened, he says a lot of people would cash in their couple of ounces of gold and paid off their houses. Boom. So that's kind of a cheap insurance policy and something that I would recommend. That's something I've done. Is buy several ounces of gold and silver so that when hyperinflation does kick in, if you do have debt, you can easily pay it off and quickly. When gold, in Germany, when hyperinflation kicked in and over in Europe, they said that an ounce of gold would buy one block downtown Berlin. So that's a lot of real estate. So keep that in mind. I think that's a good idea. So anyway, enough talking about that. I would like to get back on with Jason Akers. Jason, are you there?
I'm here.
Jason, glad to have you on. Glad to have you on. So I had a ton of questions for you guys. I've gotten a ton of emails this week asking some questions. So we are going to just jump right into this. Can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Well, I like to tell people I'm just a good old country boy. I was basically raised on a farm just south of Louisville, Kentucky, and spent most of my formative years there. And I grew up, learned how to hunt, fish, grow stuff, forage in the woods. I mean, you name it, all the stuff a country boy would learn how to do. And sometime around 2009, I got laid off. I shouldn't say around 2009. It was dead in the middle of 2009. I got laid off from my job, and I was living in the suburbs at the time. I'd kind of lost my way with the country living kind of thing, and just decided I wanted to get back to it and wanted to teach people the things I knew about it. And so I started my blog, my podcast. My podcast is called The Self-Sufficient Gardener. And just started back in trying to, relearn some of the things I'd lost and on the way teach people what I knew and what I was learning again.
Nice. Now, how long have you been doing your own gardening?
Well, I only really count about the last 16 years, although, you know, I have pictures of myself in the garden as a very young toddler with my dad. And so, I mean, I've been gardening essentially, just, you know, ever since I could walk or crawl out to the garden. So about 33 years now.
Wow. Now there's all kinds of, you know, when I type in the word gardening or gardening techniques, you realize how many search results I get through Google when you type in gardening techniques? It's ridiculous.
Everyone has an opinion about it.
That's right. It's crazy. Now, one of the first questions I actually got, and I'd like to just jump into that if you don't mind, is
sure.
the red clay.
Yep.
I don't know if this person lives in Alabama or what, but
anywhere in the south.
Anywhere in the south, yeah. So how do you grow? How do you get around that situation? Now, you know, I lived in Missouri for a short time, and I thought, you know, going to Missouri, going to the Ozarks, I thought, man, this is going to be nice. It's going to be good gardening spots. It was terrible. It was very, very rocky clay soil. It was. I mean, tons of those little rocks, just like a bunch of like pea gravel all over the place. And it was just, you know, I had 22 acres there, and I couldn't find a good spot to save my life. so in a situation like that, what is the best technique to use?
Well, I mean, what I always say is compost and mulch will fix just about any situation, whether you've got clay or silt or sand or whatever. Clay is actually one of the better soils to have because if you have something like sand, you're going to put compost down and you're going to keep putting compost down because it's just going to run right through the sand. But clay has these very small particles. So essentially whatever you put in there kind of gets trapped within the clay. And you can make concrete if you add the wrong stuff, but if you add a lot of compost, a lot of mulch, you'll start either you'll reforming the clay into good growing soil, or you'll lay a layer of soil on top of it that you only have to worry about the clay. The clay will be your substrate after that. So I always say with any soil, if you're not happy with what you have, just add compost and mulch. And people are too liberal or too conservative with their mulch. They should be more liberal with it and, you know, spread it as deep as you can possibly make it. The deeper, the better. Kind of like the Ruth Stout method, you know, it kind of combined into that a little bit.
Okay. Now, so you're saying that just grind it up right into the ground. You don't do, like, grow beds or anything like that, or?
You know, a lot of people will find that the raised bed technique, you know, is easy. I know a lot of people like the raised bed technique. I'm not a big proponent of it. Obviously, if you live somewhere like you were talking about where you have total rocks or you have, you know, bedrock you're sitting on top of, I know some of the guys down in Texas tell me that essentially it's just one sheet of rock and, there's no soil on top. Well, I mean, if you have that case, then you need to build a frame and start hauling in compost and things like that. But if you've got, you know, soil that you're just not happy with, but you can grow in the ground, I always prefer to do that. I always prefer to grow in the ground myself. But I've got all different types of bed types on my land that I grow in. But the raised bed's one thing. But I mean, if you just, you know, a lot of people spend money with the borders and with the rocks and labor and stuff like that. If you just lay compost down, you're pretty much making a raised bed there on your own. And it's gonna do just as well without borders, you know.
Interesting. Okay, so the other question I had was pest control. Now, when I did my very first garden, I was rocking it. I was so excited because I had huge plants coming up and everything was going great. And I was like telling my neighbors, showing it all off. And I came out the next day and everything had holes in it and things were just disappearing on me. And I didn't know what to do. I lost control of that garden pretty quick. it came down to pest control. I mean, what do you suggest for it? Obviously, there's a ton of different pests and a ton of different ways to probably do that. But do you have like a general, you know, start here kind of thing?
Well, I guess my pest control method's not real popular with a lot of people because it's not a real short term kind of thing. My pest control method isn't you go out to the garden and you do this one thing and, you know, the next day you don't have pests anymore. It's more of kind of a holistic approach and kind of like a Zen approach to it. When I get pests, I don't really freak out. I try to make my plants as strong as possible to resist the pests. Occasionally I do lose plants to pests, but companion planting is the biggest thing. And a lot of people say it doesn't work, but they're just not planting the right things or they're not giving it time to work. And usually you have to start this from the beginning, because if you don't, you get the garden going and you get the pests set up shop. They lay their eggs in the soil. The larvae hatch out, and next spring, you know, you've got a huge infestation. But if you plant things like just flowers, and I know this sounds kind of silly, planting flowers in your vegetable bed, but things like calendula are medicinal. If you plant dill and let it go to flower, you're getting the dill seed, you're getting the dill plant itself as part of seasoning. Anything that makes a lot of little flowers, anything that makes yellow flowers, anything that makes flowers where insects can hide, and also leaving a wild area in the garden. You know, a lot of people like these neat, tidy little gardens where they have all these rows where there's bare soil between every row of plants. You need to break up the plants a lot. You can't have, you know, a row of tomatoes and a row of broccoli and a row of peppers. You need to have, you know, space between each individual plant. Because I think of it like this: when you walk into a supermarket and you want, say, steak, you know exactly where to go to get all different kinds of steak. Well, you don't want to set your garden up like a supermarket for pests, because they walk right into the tomato aisle and they go through all your tomatoes and eat them all. Or they walk into the pepper aisle and they eat all your peppers. So I like to break things up and leave some weedy areas. The weeds hide things that are going to prey on the pest insects, things like ladybugs and green lacewings and hoverflies and parasitic wasps. So if you really build the garden and you don't try to meddle too much with spraying things like pesticides and trying to fertilize it and kill all the things in the soil, you really will have better results. It's just not going to be a short-term thing. You're going to have to kind of take it on the chin in the short term a little bit to get a garden that's going to be self-sufficient for quite a while.
So you mean that my wife, you know, she's always telling me, keep the rows straight, keep, you know, she's super organized. That's probably not the best way to go. So are you giving me an out? Is that what you're saying?
a little bit. You know, there's nothing wrong with straight rows, but, I wouldn't put, a straight row of tomatoes. I'd put a straight row and I'd have a tomato, then a basil plant, then an oregano plant, then a, you know, something else. You know what I'm saying? So tell her she can have her straight rows. Just vary what's in the rows.
Nice. All right. Okay. So on to the next question. Let's see here. We had a question from, Diary of a Health Nut was the name.
Okay.
And I can't keep stink bugs from destroying my crop right before it's harvestable. What are there some effective organic pest control techniques specifically for these dang stink bugs?
Stink bugs are tough. You know, a lot of people write stink bugs and squash bugs. You know, they're these hard-shelled bugs, and the way the reproductive cycle works is a lot of bugs have a complete life cycle, and some have an incomplete life cycle. And I may be mixing my terms, but I believe stink bugs, squash bugs are incomplete life cycles. So they basically lay eggs. The eggs hatch into little miniature versions of themselves, and then they shed until they get to adult. So that makes them especially tough, because it's hard to use something on there that's going to actually essentially get them while they're vulnerable, because they're never really vulnerable. You can put up habitat for birds, things like bluebirds and purple martins will help a little bit, but they're not going to just totally devastate them, because, you know, squash bugs and stink bugs are quick, and nothing likes to eat them because they pretty much stink. About the best thing I've found for both of them, and this is just a mechanical control. I mean, you can spray things, or you can put diatomaceous earth down, and that will help. But again, you're going to kill some good bugs, and it's just going to be kind of a short term option. But if you were to lay down things like a 2x4, just a short 1 foot length of 2x4, and put a string on it, and pull it up. And, you know, every so often lay it on the ground and then wait, you know, a couple of days and pull it up, they're going to concentrate underneath that board, and you can just stomp the heck out of them. And, you know, you'll control a pot. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Squash bugs especially, and I'm pretty sure it'll work for stink bugs as well, too. They're both in the same family. They're the shield type of bugs. So they're looking for cover.
So they'll go right underneath that 2x4 and stay underneath there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yep. Sweet.
Yeah, and also with squash bugs, one of the things that will work real well for squash bugs is also, I just lost my train of thought here.
sorry.
Oh, the eggs. When they lay the eggs on the leaves, if you knock the eggs off and squash the eggs, you can control the life cycle a little bit. I don't know if it works the same way as stink bugs. I haven't had a whole lot of trouble with stink bugs.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm taking notes myself here. I'm gonna talk to my wife here. I'm gonna tell her what an awesome gardener I'm gonna be this year. So I went out and I've been looking at plans to do a greenhouse because, you know, here in Colorado, it's to get our starts going, it'd be nice to have a little greenhouse. So I've been trying to convince her that I need a greenhouse.
I just did an episode you'll like on a greenhouse. I built one for about $225. 6x10.
I know. That's where I saw it. I saw it on your website. speaking of that, the selfsufficientgardener.com is his website, and that's where I was when I saw it. Episode 152, I believe. It was a low-budget greenhouse. And so I saw that, and I was like, see? He can do it. He can do it. I can do it. So
yeah,
I was
and
like,
I'm
oh, here we go. So now, one question I had for you – speaking of greenhouses, I had this brilliant idea. my wife always gives me that look. She's already given me that look across the room. But I had this idea. Now, because the ground freezes here and it gets so cold, but under about a foot of ground, you know, the temperature, you know, steadies out about 67 degrees or so. Now, what if I dug my greenhouse down and I had, say, you know, 6 feet of greenhouse above the ground and 3 feet of greenhouse below the ground.
Oh yeah,
do you think that would help?
Awesome.
Do you think that would help?
Oh yeah,
absolutely. Really?
Oh. Yeah, yeah. My greenhouse, it was funny. When I first put it in and I put the plastic on, I thought, you know, I went into it and I thought, this is just not, it's not working. It's not. It's maybe 5 degrees warmer and it sucks and I'm mad. I spent all this money on it. And so I tried to do things to improve it. One thing I did is I took dirt and just buried the bottom of the plastic, which just seems kind of stupid. And I can't believe I didn't do it until then. After I did that, it raised it about 10 degrees, and then I put a black plastic curtain at the back of it where the sun would hit it through the greenhouse, and that raises about another 15. So I'm getting about 20 to 25 degrees gain.
Nice.
Right now.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, because that's my crazy idea. I told my wife, I said, we're gonna dig down about 3 foot, and I was going to build a ramp out, you know, so that I could take a wheelbarrow right in if I wanted to. But I was gonna dig it down about 3 foot and then keep about, you know, anywhere between about 5 feet above the ground. But
yeah, I think it's great. It'll have, you know, the thermal mass down in there where it'll kind of even the temperature out a lot. That'll help.
Oh, yeah. That's on the list now. Dig it out. Big greenhouse. Okay. Sorry. Just making my own list, guys. All right. On to the next question. We've got another question here, and this one is from Minnesota. Now, this one, Minnesota. All right. Becky wrote in, and she said, how do you store enough wild or homegrown food to last long winters, and what is the best way to save the green stuff? I assume she means green stuff as far as, like, I don't know, what is the best way to save the green stuff? Does she mean money, or does she mean, like,
lettuce and spinach and stuff? I don't know. Green stuff.
The green stuff. Probably, like, spinach and kale and all that stuff. Because it doesn't last very long.
No, it doesn't. And I think probably about the best way to store like things like that is make sure where you plant it, you can end up putting something like a row cover over it. And row covers are pretty cheap. You just get some water pipe. You can get it at Lowe's, just like these short lengths of water pipe. Don't get PVC. PVC will break in the cold. But if you get this water pipe, you can bend it and just stab it in two ends of the ground and run just a length of plastic over it and get the bury the plastic a little bit, like I didn't like super leave my greenhouse plastic, and that'll help lock some of the heat in during the day and keep the frost off. And you can grow, depending on where you're at. Obviously, this lady's or whoever it was that wrote in is in Minnesota, right? So
yeah,
it's gonna be a little bit tougher for them. I mean, kale may be one of the only things that they can keep going up there outside. Cold frames. I've got lettuce going right now in a cold frame. I planted it in January, and it's sprouting and growing pretty well.
Really?
The key thing with things, yeah. So I was surprised by that too. But yeah, you can keep lettuce or spinach. You know, some things you keep going all year round. Spinach especially, you can keep going. Now, it won't grow real well in the cold, but as soon as the warm weather comes back, it'll just bounce right back and go crazy. But it's storing things through the winter, the best approach is kind of varied. It depends on what you have, but canning always works, dehydrating works, using a root cellar works, especially if you don't want to lose some of the nutrients you're going to lose by canning it. It just kind of depends on what you like.
What's the best way to do a root cellar? I've seen some pretty inexpensive ways. You know, one of the cool things about having Backwoods Home Magazine is I've got all the issues. All the back issues. So what's cool about that is I can go back and see all these different root cellar designs and things throughout the years that people have made. They don't have to be very deep, do they?
No, they really don't. And I've got a friend nearby that's he's going to try this out this winter, this next coming up winter. He's going to actually do it over the summer. But he's got just a crawl space under his house. He's going to go in there and dig, about a 2 or 3 foot hole. And put these Tupperware totes down in there, and you'll just see what he can do with that. He thinks that will pretty much even them out. But yeah, basically just if you have like a side of a hill, and you go in there and you just dig out the side of the hill and you kind of brace it up. It doesn't, like you said, doesn't have to be big. One of the things I did see in Backwoods Home that I'm probably going to end up trying this year is they dig a, I think they've got this diagram where you dig this hole. And you get a galvanized, just metal, one of the metal trash cans. You set, you set it right down the hole. I mean, so you
might. I saw that too. I was like, "Oh, baby, I'm gonna do this." She's like, "Oh no, what are you doing?"
you'll have a little treasure chest all out in your yard.
That's right, totally. It's like I got fresh carrots and you don't. But yeah, so. I was looking at that too. Is that the trash can root cellar is what they called it basically, and all it was pretty much just a buried galvanized trash can, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. You just kind of humped everything up on top, maybe put a few straw bales and a blanket over it, and then covered up with more straw on. I mean, it was that seems like that would work very well to me anyway. I mean, you want to go into the ground. You want to take some of the evenness of the temperature away, and you're going to keep it away. You're going to keep the frost away. You're going to keep the rain away, and you're going to keep keep it a little bit. It's going to be cold just by virtue of being out in the winter. So
How do you separate the vegetables in that root cellar? I got to go back and read that article, I guess. But do you cover it in dirt or do you cover it in straw
sand works real well too. Sand or straw, both, either one will kind of drain fairly well. But either or, sand or straw, you layer like a layer of carrots down, and then you put straw or sand down, then another layer, and then more straw and sand. Just keep layering them like that. You don't want them to touch each other because that will end up causing rot and things like that. But that definitely layering them in there, not letting them touch, is going to do it for you.
Now. Just out of a quick thinking, just thinking of this this 5 gallon, or I don't even know how many gallons, basically the trash can one. I would imagine that using straw would be the easiest way because it's easier to get that stuff out of there, dig it back out.
Yeah.
Than the sand.
You're probably right. Yeah, you probably would be right in that regard. I'm trying to remember if the straw was the best use for the sand. I literally can't remember, but I know I'm gonna, as soon as I'm done with this, I'm gonna go on Backwoods Home website and see.
Yeah.
So, I gotta know now. I'm curious myself. So,
I don't know if Backwoods Home magazine is a blessing or if it's getting me in more trouble because I keep doing these new projects. And my wife's like, "You've been reading the magazine again, haven't you?"
My wife says the exact same thing. She's like, "Where'd you learn how to do that at?" So, like, don't worry about it.
That's right. Don't worry. It's funny. Now, one of the articles you had, and this is another thing that interests me, is bees. raising bees. Are we, you know, I hear about this, you know, and I'm totally not into bees right now. I have no history on bees, you know, every time I talk to a beekeeper, it sounds like the end of the world is coming for bees. What is going on with these guys? Are we really having some problems out there with bees or what?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it I blame on is something's going to get me in trouble for speaking my mind again here. But basically, bees, we've taken a non-native entity and tried to introduce it into a place where it adapted well, but it didn't really belong. And we've tried to use so many modern techniques to grow our food, like pesticides and GMOs and things like that. And now we're finding something that's not adapted to our continent and our climate is running into something that we're screwing up with the environment, and it's having a hard time, and we're having trouble figuring out why. And it's like, it's not too much of a stretch to figure this one out. But yeah, one of my articles I had on the blog, I actually had a guest post, and I've talked about it on the website. It's trying to introduce and involve native pollinators in your garden and orchard, because I mean, they're the ones you really have to rely upon is the natives. A lot of people don't know this, but things like squash, a lot of people have trouble getting squash to even pollinate. If you plant zucchinis out in your garden or summer squash, and you know, you get the flowers and you never get fruit, and you think, what the heck happened? Well, what happened was honeybees come in there, and honeybees can't even pick up the pollen and move it from flower to flower, and you have to have flower to flower pollen movement because you have male and female flowers on a squash plant. And what's happening is essentially, even if a honeybee gets in there, it can't. Its hairs are too spaced too close together to pick up the large pollen grains, and so it can't move the pollen. So you end up, you know, not making fruit. You have to end up pollinating yourself. But you attract these native pollinators in, you get things that were here already. You know, squash was already on our continent, so were squash bees. So you know, they kind of co-evolved together. So that's why I'm a big proponent of native plants and native pollinators when you can find them.
Interesting. Okay. Well, you know, and that's a good point. You know, as far as the beekeeping goes, you know, I've been wanting to do this for a while, and this may be the year I try and tackle that. who knows? You know, I'm trying to tackle a greenhouse. I'm trying to, you know, we did some grow beds because we live in kind of a rural neighborhood. So I wanted to do raised beds just for the ease, because I'm lazy. I don't like to sit on the ground and pick weeds. So we did the grow beds and stuff. And so I've been working on that. And so it's a lot to tackle. But man, I tell you what, every time I read this doggone magazine, it jump starts me to do more projects, and I don't know if I'm biting off more than I could chew here.
You never can bite. I mean, I just go from one to another, and my wife just laughs at me. But bees are definitely they're harder for me anyway. I'm no huge expert on honeybees, but I did install a package last year, and they stayed around for about 3 months before they decided that I wasn't doing them any justice and moved on. And I'm gonna try it again this year with a new type of hive and see what happens, and maybe I'll have a little bit more expertise after this year. But right now I'm kind of a novice at honeybees, so I just, maybe that's why I like the native pollinators. They won't leave when I get them.
There you go. Now, what about raising animals? You do much of that?
I have done a lot of it in the past, and I'm starting to get back into it. Obviously, you know, up until July of last year, I was on a suburban lot, and I wasn't technically allowed to keep any animals, but I did have chickens, which was totally against the law. I just kept them in my garage and tried to keep them quiet when I could, and kept that going. But the plan when I get moved to my homestead, which is probably going to be May or June of this coming year, this year actually 2012, is going to, you know, I've got plans for animals of all types. I've actually got chickens, more chickens on order from Murray McMurray Hatchery. I've got a guy set up to get me some rabbits, some New Zealand white rabbits. Pigs are in the plan, goats are in the plan, ducks are in the plan. So yeah, I have the expertise and I have the room now. It's just a matter of getting the time and getting everything done.
Yeah. Now explain your homestead. Describe it a
little bit. Well, it's in western Kentucky. It's actually on Kentucky Lake, and by on Kentucky Lake, I mean I can see Kentucky Lake. I can walk to Kentucky Lake from my front porch, essentially. And it's almost 4 acres, just right under 4 acres, mostly wooded, but I've done a lot of clearing, a lot of bulldozing work in there. And I've got a lot of stuff set up already, but the big thing's the cabin, which we're still working on. In fact, I'm going over there tomorrow. We're trying to finish up the plumbing. My dad's been helping me out a lot. Luckily he's a contractor, so at least I don't have to be the idiot swinging the hammer because I'm no good at it. And so the cabin's kind of the centerpiece. We've got a fairly large garden. We've got a duck run of the little duck house I've been working on, a pretty big chicken coop. The beehives, a little pond I'm hand digging, which has been a lot of work. Fruit trees, kind of like a little mini food forest kind of thing going on. Lots of raspberries, blackberries, hazelnut bushes. Just a whole lot of stuff going on. I mean, it boggles my mind every time I go over there. There's always something to work on.
Oh, man, you're telling me. I'm amazed how much we were able to get in on this. We got about a third of an acre here, and I'm just amazed. We were able to get berry patches in. We've got raspberries and blackberries, and we've got the garden going, and I'm getting ready to put the greenhouse in, and we've got six fruit trees going in. So it's amazing how much you can actually put. You know, everybody thinks you need, 100 acres, but you really don't. It's amazing how much you can fit on a lot, whether it's an acre or 2 acres.
I mean, that's completely right. And people may look at me and go, well, you have 4 acres. But really the concentration of what everything that's going on happens within probably less than an acre. I mean, I've got all this stuff going on in around about an acre of it. The other 2 or 3 acres is essentially forest. So,
well, exactly, and that's what that's one of the things I noticed when I was in Missouri, is we had 22 or 25 acres, but not, 9 times out of 10, 99% of my time was spent, within an acre around the house, and everything else was just forest and maintenance and fence posts and, working on all that stuff. So yeah, it's kind of funny that you say that. And that was kind of the deciding factor. I actually moved back to a more urban for myself, to see if I could actually do it in an urban environment. So, but one of the questions, another question I had for you was the, I see one of the articles you had in your, on your website was about, Muscovy ducks.
That was a guest post a friend of mine actually put on there. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now my buddy is trying to convince me that Muscovy ducks are better than chickens. Do you agree with that?
Say no. for me personally, and again, it's just probably dependent upon circumstances, but no, I like chickens better. For one thing, you don't really have to, there's no water source required. And don't get me wrong, Muscovies require, you could do like a 5-gallon bucket full of water buried, and they would be probably pretty happy with that. Duck eggs are great. But chickens are the chickens can stand being cooped up a little bit more, and I don't like to keep them too cooped up. But ducks are going to want to get out, and personally, my experience is ducks always get eaten by snapping turtles down here in the south. And so I'm not a huge duck person, ducks have their place. Ducks are great. I mean, I think having both would be the optimal thing. But if you have to choose one or the other, I'd always choose chickens for me. So
yeah. Now this. I don't know if you remember this picture of what's in this picture on this article. It looks like a sushi platter here.
Yeah, my friend Andrew, he's the one who wrote the article. He went to I believe somewhere in Toronto, and I mean he was eating all these fancy duck platters. So he thought that was if you want to want to convince people to raise ducks for food, that was one way to do it.
I was looking at that thinking, oh man, that is delicious.
I know. I was like, good enough to eat the picture. I'm looking at the screen right here.
Exactly. Now. If we have people on all different levels of gardening, if there was one thing that you would tell people to start to do or to look into or start reading, what would it be?
As far as reading material, a lot of the gardening books that I've picked up tend to be very heavy on a certain technique. So they tend to be like, you know, you'll find one that just talks about raised beds, or you'll find one that just talks about square foot gardening, or one that talks about, you know, cold weather gardening or something like that. And it's really tough to find a garden book that talks about organic kind of holistic methods that that covers, you know, them broadly. I mean, all these books are going to tell you, you know, the basics you need to know about how to grow carrots or lettuce or something like that, but they're going to focus on one technique. For me, the book I would probably recommend, and it's going to kind of throw people, is a book about permaculture called Earth User's Guide to Permaculture by Rosemary Morrow, and it will make you look at gardening and raising food in a totally different light altogether. It's not going to tell you, you know, go plant carrots by doing this, but it's going to tell you, here's the things you need to look for when you're picking a plant, and here's, you know, the things you need to educate yourself about. And I don't like books that just drone on and on and say plant carrot seeds a quarter of an inch deep and water them three times per day. You know, they give these instructions. I like the books that challenge me and tell me, here's what you need to think about when you're doing that. And that's kind of how I've started trying to teach people is, you know, I'm not going to tell you, you know, use a raised bed or use an in-ground garden. I'm going to tell you, you know, think about what's going to work best on your soil and your conditions and in your ground, and use diversity when you can.
Okay. Good. I wrote that one down. So Earth User's Permaculture Guide. Is that right? Did I get that right?
Earth User's Guide to Permaculture.
Oh, Earth User's Guide to Permaculture. Okay. All right. So Earth User's Guide to Permaculture. All right. So we got that one. Now, how long have you been working with Backwoods Home magazine?
Backwoods Home was actually the first magazine I sold an article to. I've been writing probably ever since, I've been writing as long as I've been gardening. So ever since I could pick up a pencil, I've been writing about stuff. And 2008, 2009, I wrote an article on James Rawls' blog, survival blog. And it was about fishing for catfish with trot lines and limb lines and things like that. And I thought, after he published it, I kind of got some pretty good feedback. I thought, well, I should have actually submitted it to Backwoods Home. So I asked him, could I have it back? luckily, he's a pretty gracious guy. He said, yeah, sure, you can have it back. No big deal. And I submitted to Backwoods Home, and they published it. And ever since then, I've kind of been on a roll. I sell about 2 to 3 articles a month to just various publications. But Backwoods Home, if I write something about hunting or fishing or just, you know, what I call redneck skills, kind of things like that, they will publish it. They will buy anything I write on that. And I've been very grateful that they're great people to work with. They really are, and very responsive to when I want to write something and tell me what I need and what I need to do. And I've been glad I've met those people for sure.
You know what really impresses me about Dave Duffy and his crew up there is they're actually picky on their articles. they read every one of them, and if they, you know, if it's not formatted correctly, or if it's not if it's a lot of fluff, they send it back. They want good information, and I'm really grateful for that because it saves me a ton of time. I'm really not a fan of magazines that have a lot of what I call fluff articles.
You can tell someone's going on the internet and getting, you know, information off of an easy article, or they've actually had to live this stuff and they've actually done it themselves. And that's why always when I write the article, I try to include a story about, you know, one time I was out duck hunting and, you know. So.
Yeah, it's totally obvious when they don't, you know, when they don't have the experience there. All right, leave me alone. Okay, so we're almost out of time here. Let's see here. The best way to find Jason is theselfsufficientgardener.com. Is that correct?
That is correct. www.theselfsufficientgardener.com.
Okay. Now, when they go here, where would you like them to go first? Is there any particular spot
I've got a little tab up the top that says new ? Start here. And it's essentially a lot of the not necessarily beginner articles, but it tells a lot about why I'm doing it. And, just some of the basics essentially.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, get you started. Look at dirt. Oh, okay. So, yeah, you got some good articles here. Let's see here. Why a garden, look at dirt, mulch, beginning gardening self-sufficiently. Okay, perfect. Okay, yeah, so that's great. Okay, so basically go to selfsufficientgardener.com and click on the new *start here tab at the top, and that should get you started. All right, perfect. Well, that's great. Hey, I really appreciate you coming on. I really appreciate our sponsor, Backwoods Home Magazine. Dave Duffy and his crew up there, they're just awesome. I mean, everybody I talk to just loves them, guys. So if you guys do not have a subscription to Backwoods Home Magazine, grab it now, because almost everything we talk about comes out of these magazines. And so you can kind of follow along with us. Again, thank you, Jason, for coming on and taking some time away from your evening, your Friday night there with us. I really appreciate it. Everybody else, you bet. Everybody else, next week we'll be back on next Friday night with Self-Reliance Exposed, and hopefully Bubba Da Vinci will be back in town. So thanks again for everybody for joining, and we'll talk with you later.
You've been listening to BHM Radio, the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine on the Preparedness Radio Network. Tune in every other week at this time to get more information on the articles you love. Questions or comments for the hosts? Email them at coloradoron@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives.
I'm Dr. Prepper, and I'm here today to tell you about the Wonder Mill. Their patented grain mills create the most luxurious and quality flours from any hard grains or beans. They contract with the world's best-suited factories to manufacture the Wonder Mill to the highest specifications in the industry that they plan and design right up there in Pocatello, Idaho. They're the only American company with both electric and hand-operated models. I like them so much, I bought both, and you should too. I use the electric model for the finest flour, and I use the hand-operated model for making my grits and creamy wheat for breakfast, and I can have it fresh every day. With the Wonder Mill's lifetime warranty and the fact that these are simply the world's fastest, quietest, cleanest operating grain mills, it's no wonder that most preparedness and kitchen professionals prefer the Wonder Mill over all the other grain mills on the market. I love both mine. I know you'll love yours, too. Go to thewondermill.com. That's thewondermill.com. And Wonder Mill Grain Grinders. Get yours today. Tell them that Dr. Prepper sent you, will you?
Discover the taste of the sun. Thousands of preppers have acquired a sun oven to have on hand in the event of an emergency and have been pleasantly surprised by the improved taste of sun-cooked foods. Sun ovens are a preparedness item you can start using today. A sun oven will pay for itself by reducing your utility bills and by keeping your house cooler in the summer. Food can be baked, boiled, or steamed at temperatures of 360 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit with the power of the sun. Sun ovens are often confused with homemade solar cookers, but they get considerably hotter, cook food faster, and hold temperatures longer. Sun ovens fold up in seconds, carry like a suitcase, and have many innovative features which make them the ultimate solar appliance. For the past 25 years, sun ovens have been proudly made in the U.S. They are durable and have a long life and come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. For a discount coupon, email preppers@sunoven.com. That's preppers@sunoven.com.
You've been listening to the Preparedness Radio Network, offering helpful and timely tips on preparing for natural and man-made disasters. Timely and useful tips on gardening and homesteading. Check us out online at BePreparedRadio.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.